not blood. Little bird, he said once more, his voice raw and harsh as steel on stone. Then he rose from the bed. Sansa heard cloth ripping, followed by the softer sound of retreating footsteps. When she crawled out of bed, long moments later, she was alone. She found his cloak on the floor, twisted up tight, the white wall stained by blood and fire. The sky outside was darker by then, with only a few pale green ghosts dancing against the stars. A chill wind was blowing, banging the shutters. Sansa was cold. She shook out the torn cloak and huddled beneath it on the floor, shivering. How long she stayed there she could not have said, but after a time she heard a bell ringing, far off across the city. The sound was a deep-throated bronze booming, coming faster with each knell. Sansa was wondering what it might mean when a second bell joined in, and a third, their voices calling across the hills and hollows, the alleys and towers, to every corner of King's Landing. She threw off the cloak and went to her window. The first faint hint of dawn was visible in the east, and the Red Keep's own bells were ringing now, joining in the swelling river of sound that flowed from the seven crystal towers of the great Sept of Baelor. They had rung the bells when King Robert died, she remembered, but this was different. No slow, dolorous death knell, but a joyful thunder. She could hear men shouting in the streets as well, and something that could only be cheers. It was Sedontis who brought her the word. He staggered through her open door, wrapped her in his flabby arms, and whirled her round and around the room, whooping so incoherently that Sansa understood not a word of it. He was as drunk as the hound had been, but in him it was a dancing, happy drunk. She was breathless and dizzy when he let her down. "What is it?" she clutched at a bedpost. "What's happened? Tell me." "It's done. The city is saved. Lord Stannis is dead. Lord Stannis has fled. No one knows. No one cares. His host is broken. The danger's gone. Slaughtered, scattered, or gone over, they say. Oh, the bright banners, the banners, Jonquil, the banners. You have any wine? We ought to drink to this day. Yes. It means you're safe, don't you see?" "Tell me what's happened." Sansa shook him. Sedontis laughed and hopped from one leg to the other, almost falling. "They came up through the ashes while the river was burning. The river, oh, Stannis was neck deep in the river, and they took him from the rear. Oh, to be a knight again, to have been part of it. His own men hardly fought, they say. Some ran, but more bent the knee and went over, shouting for Lord Renly. What must Stannis have thought when he heard that? I had it from Osney Kettleblack, who had it from Sir Osmond, but Sir Balin's back now, and his men say the same. And the gold cloaks as well. We're delivered, sweet laden. They came up the Rose Road and along the river bank, through all the fields Stannis had burned, the ashes puffing up around their boots and turning all their armour grey. But, oh, the banners must have been bright. The golden rose and golden lion and all the others, the Marbrand tree and the rowan, Tarly's huntsman and red wine's grapes and Lady Oakheart's leaf, all the Westermen, all the power of Highgarden and Castle Rock, Lord Tywin himself had their right wing on the north side of the river, with Randall Tarly commanding the centre and Mace Tyrell the left, but the vanguard won the fight. They plunged through Stannis like a lance through a pumpkin. Every man of them howling like some demon in steel. And you know who led the vanguard? Do you? Do you? Do you?" "Rob?" It was too much to be hoped, but It was Lord Renly, Lord Renly in his green armour with the fire shimmering off his golden antlers. Lord Renly with his tall spear in his hand. They say he killed Sir Gaiad Morrigan himself in single combat and a dozen other knights as well. It was Renly, it was Renly, it was Renly. Oh, the banners, darling, Sansa. Oh, to be a knight.
The Sacrifice. On the village green, the queen's men built their pyre. Or should it be the village white? The snow was knee-deep everywhere but where the men had shoveled it away, to hack holes into the frozen ground with axe and spade and pick. The wind was swirling from the west, driving still more snow across the frozen surface of the lakes. "You do not want to watch this," Ali Mormont said. "No, but I will." Asha Greyjoy was the Kraken's daughter, not some pampered maiden who could not bear to look at ugliness. It had been a dark, cold, hungry day, like the day before and the day before that. They had spent most of it out on the ice, shivering beside a pair of holes they'd cut in the smaller of the frozen lakes, with fishing lines clutched in mittened clumsy hands. Not long ago they could count on hooking one or two fish apiece, and Wolfswood men, more practiced at ice fishing, were pulling up four or five. Today all that Asher had come back with was a chill that went bone deep. Ali had fared no better. It had been 3 days since either of them had caught a fish. The she-bear tried again. "I do not need to watch this." "It is not you the queen's men want to burn." "Then go. You have my word, I will not run." "Where would I go? To Winterfell?" Asher laughed. "Only 3 days' ride, they tell me." Six queen's men were wrestling two enormous pinewood poles into holes six other queen's men had dug out. Asher did not have to ask their purpose. She knew. Stakes. Nightfall would be on them soon, and the Red Guard must be fed. "An offering of blood and fire," the queen's men called it, "that the Lord of Light may turn his fiery eye upon us and melt these thrice-cursed snows. Even in this place of fear and darkness, the Lord of Light protects us," Sir Godfrey Fearing told the men who gathered to watch as the stakes were hammered down into the holes. "What has your southern god to do with snow?" demanded Artos Flint. His black beard was crusted with ice. "This is the wrath of the old gods come upon us. It is them we should appease." "Aye," said Big Bucket Wald. "Red Rollo means nothing here. You will only make the old gods angry. They are watching from their island." The Crofters' village stood between two lakes, the larger dotted with small wooded islands that punched up through the ice like the frozen fists of some drowned giant. From one such island rose a weirwood, gnarled and ancient, its bole and branches white as the surrounding snows. 8 days ago, Asher had walked out with Ali Mormont to have a closer look at its slitted red eyes and bloody mouth. "It is only sap," she told herself. "The red sap that flows inside these weirwoods." But her eyes were unconvinced. Seeing was believing, and what they saw was frozen blood. "Your Northmen brought these snows upon us," insisted Corlys Penny. "You and your demon trees. Rillor will save us."
"Rillor will doom us," said Artus Flint.
"A pox on both your gods," thought Asher Greyjoy.
Sir Godfrey, the giant slayer, surveyed the stakes, shoving one to make certain it was firmly placed.
"Good, good. They will serve. Sir Clayton, bring forth the sacrifice."
Sir Clayton Suggs was Godfrey's strong right hand. Or should it be his withered arm? Asher did not like Sir Clayton. Where Fearing seemed fierce in his devotion to his red god, Suggs was simply cruel. She had seen him at the night fires, watching, his lips parted and his eyes avid. "It is not the god he loves, it is the flames," she concluded. When she asked Sir Justin if Suggs had always been that way, he grimaced.
"On Dragonstone, he would gamble with the torturers and lend them a hand in the questioning of prisoners, especially if the prisoner were a young woman."
Asher was not surprised. Suggs would take a special delight in burning her, she did not doubt.
"Unless the storms let up."
There had been 3 days from Winterfell for 19 days.
100 leagues from Deepwood Mott to Winterfell, 300 miles as the raven flies.
But none of them were ravens, and the storm was unrelenting. Each morning Asher awoke, hoping she might see the sun, only to face another day of snow. The storm had buried every hut and hovel beneath a mound of dirty snow, and the drifts would soon be deep enough to engulf the long haul too. And there was no food, beyond their failing horses, fish taken from the lakes, fewer every day, and whatever meagre sustenance their foragers could find in these cold, dead woods. With the king's knights and lords claiming the lion's share of the horse meat, little and less remained for the common men. Small wonder, then, that they had started eating their own dead. Asher had been as horrified as the rest when the she-bear told her that 4 Peasbury men had been found butchering one of the late Lord Fells, carving chunks of flesh from his thighs and buttocks as one of his forearms turned upon a spit. But she could not pretend to be surprised. The 4 were not the first to taste human flesh during this grim march, she would wager, only the first to be discovered. Peasbury's 4 would pay for their feast with their lives, by the king's decree, and by burning end the storm, the queen's men claimed. Asher Greyjoy put no faith in their red god, yet she prayed that they had the right of that. If not, there would be other pyres, and Sir Clayton Suggs might get his heart's desire. The 4 flesh-eaters were naked when Sir Clayton drove them out, their wrists lashed behind their backs with leathern cords. The youngest of them wept as he stumbled through the snow. 2 others walked like men already dead, eyes fixed upon the ground. Asher was surprised to see how ordinary they appeared.
"Not monsters," she realized, "only men."
The oldest of the 4 had been their sergeant. He alone remained defiant, spitting venom at the queen's men as they prodded him along with their spears.
"Fuck you all, and fuck your red god too," he said. "You hear me, Fairing? Giant slayer? Ha! I laughed when your fucking cousin died, Godfrey. We should have eaten him too. He smelled so good when they roasted him. Ha! I bet the boy was nice and tender. Juicy!"
A blow from a spear butt drove the man to his knees, but did not silence him. When he rose, he spat out a mouthful of blood and broken teeth, and went right on.
"The cock's the choicest part. All crisp up on the spit. A fat little sausage."
Even as they wrapped the chains around him, he raved on.
"Call us Penny, come over here. What sort of name is Penny? Is that how much your mother charged? And you, Suggs, you bleeding bastard, you—"
Sir Clayton never said a word. 1 quick slash opened the sergeant's throat, sending a wash of blood down his chest. The weeping man wept harder, his body shaking with each sob. He was so thin that Asher could count every rib.
"No, he begged, please, he was dead, and we was hungry, please."
"The sergeant was the clever one," Asher said to Ali Mormont. "He goaded Suggs into killing him." She wondered if the same trick might work twice, should her own turn come. The 4 victims were chained up back to back, 2 to a stake. There they hung, 3 live men and 1 dead one, as the Lord of Light's devout stacked split logs and broken branches under their feet, then doused the piles with lamp oil. They had to be swift about it. The snow was falling heavily, as ever, and the wood would soon be soaked through. "Where is the king?" asked Sir Corliss Penny. 4 days ago, one of the king's own squires had succumbed to cold and hunger, a boy named Byron Faring, who had been kin to Sir Godfrey. Stannis Baratheon stood grim-faced by the funeral pyre as the lad's body was consigned to the flames. Afterward, the king had retreated to his watchtower. He had not emerged since, though from time to time his grace was glimpsed upon the tower roof, outlined against the beacon fire that burned there night and day. "Talking to the Red God," some said. "Calling out for Lady Melisandre," insisted others. Either way, it seemed to Asher Greyjoy the king was lost and crying out for help. "Canty, go find the king and tell him all is ready," Sir Godfrey said to the nearest man-at-arms.
"The king is here."
The voice was Richard Hawke's. Over his armour of plate and mail, Sir Richard wore his quilted doublet, blazoned with 3 death's head moths on a field of ash and bone. King Stannis walked beside him. Behind them, struggling to keep pace, Arnulf Karstark came hobbling, leaning on his blackthorn cane. Lord Arnulf had found them 8 days past. The Northmen had brought a son, 3 grandsons, 400 spears, 20 archers, 12 mounted lances, a maester, and a cage of ravens, but only enough provisions to sustain his own. Karstark was no lord, in truth, Asher had been given to understand, only a castellan of Garhold, for as long as the true lord remained a captive of the Lannisters. Gaunt and bent and crooked, with a left shoulder 1/2 foot higher than his right, he had a scrawny neck, squinty grey eyes, and yellow teeth. A few white hairs were all that separated him from baldness. His forked beard was equal parts white and grey, but always ragged. Asher thought there was something sour about his smiles. Yet if the talk was true, it was Karstark who would hold Winterfell, should they take it. Somewhere in the distant past, House Karstark had sprouted from House Stark, and Lord Arnulf had been the first of Eddard Stark's bannermen to declare for Stannis. So far as Asher knew, the guards of the Karstarks were the old guards of the North, guards they shared with the Wolves, the Norris, the Flints, and the other hill clans. She wondered if Lord Arnulf had come to view the burning at the king's behest, that he might witness the power of the Red God for himself. At the sight of Stannis, 2 of the men bound to the stakes began to plead for mercy. The king listened in silence, his jaw clenched. Then he said to Godfrey Faring, "You may begin." The giant slayer raised his arms. "Lord of Light, hear us!" "Lord of Light, defend us," the queen's men chanted, "for the night is dark and full of terrors." Sir Godfrey raised his head towards the darkening sky. "We thank you for the sun that warms us, and pray that you will return it to us, O Lord, that it might light our path to your enemies." Snowflakes melted on his face. "We thank you for the stars that watch over us by night, and pray that you will rip away this veil that hides them, so we might glory in their sight once more." "Lord of Light, protect us," the queen's men prayed, "and keep this savage dark at bay." Sir Corliss Penny stepped forward, clutching the torch with both hands. He swung it about his head in a circle, fanning the flames. One of the captives began to whimper. "Rilor," Sir Godfrey sang, "we give you now 4 evil men, with glad hearts and true, we give them to your cleansing fires, that the darkness in their souls might be burned away. Let their vile flesh be seared and blackened, that their spirits might rise free and pure to ascend into the light. Accept their blood, O Lord, and melt the icy chains
that bind your servants. Hear their pain, and grant strength to our swords, that we might shed the blood of your enemies. Accept this sacrifice, and show us the way to Winterfell, that we might vanquish the unbelievers. Lord of Light, accept this sacrifice, 100 voices echoed. Sir Corlys lit the first pyre with the torch, then thrust it into the wood at the base of the second. A few wisps of smoke began to rise. The captives began to cough. The first flames appeared, shy as maidens darting and dancing from log to leg. In moments both the stakes were engulfed in fire.
"He was dead,"
the weeping boy screamed as the flames licked up his legs.
"We found him dead. Please, we was hungry."
The fires reached his balls as the hair around his cock began to burn. His pleading dissolved into one long, wordless shriek. Asha Greyjoy could taste the bile in the back of her throat. On the Arran Islands, she had seen priests of her own people slit the throats of thralls and give their bodies to the sea to honour the drowned god. Brutal as that was, this was worse.
"Close your eyes," she told herself. "Close your ears. Turn away. You do not need to see this."
The Queen's men were singing some paean of praise for Red Valour, but she could not hear the words above the shrieks. The heat of the flames beat against her face, but even so she shivered. The air grew thick with smoke and the stink of burnt flesh, and one of the bodies still twitched against the red-hot chains that bound him to the stake. After a time, the screaming stopped. Wordless, King Stannis walked away, back to the solitude of his watchtower. Back to his beacon fire, Asha knew, to search the flames for answers. Arn of Karstak made to hobble after him, but Sir Richard Horp took him by the arm and turned him toward the long hall. The watchers began to drift away, each to his own fire and whatever meager supper he might find. Clayton Suggs sidled up beside her. "Did the Iron Cunt enjoy the show?" His breath stank of ale and onions. "He has pig eyes," Asha thought. That was fitting. His shield and surcoat showed a pig with wings. Suggs pressed his face so close to hers that she could count the blackheads on his nose and said, "The crowd will be even bigger when it's you squirming on a stake." He was not wrong. The wolves did not love her. She was ironborn and must answer for the crimes of her people, for Moat Cailin and Deepwood Mott and Torren Square, for centuries of reaving along the stony shore, for all Theon did at Winterfell. "Unhand me, sir." Every time Sugg spoke to her, it left her yearning for her axes. Asha was as good a finger dancer as any man on the Isles, and had 10 fingers to prove it. "If only I could dance with this one." Some men had faces that cried out for a beard. Sir Clayton's face cried out for an axe between the eyes. But she was axeless here, so the best she could do was to try to wrench away. That just made Sir Clayton grasp her all the tighter, glove fingers digging into her arm like iron claws.
"My lady asked you to let her go," said Ali Mormont. "You would do well to listen, sir. Lady Asha is not for burning."
"She will be," Suggs insisted. "We have harboured this demon worshipper amongst us too long."
He released his grip on Asher's arm all the same. One did not provoke the she-bear needlessly. That was the moment Justin Massey chose to appear.
"The king has other plans for his prize captive," he said with his easy smile. His cheeks were red from the cold.
"The king or you?" Sugg snorted his contempt. "Scheme all you like, Massey. She'll still be for the fire, her and her king's blood. There's power in king's blood, the Red Woman used to say. power to please our lord.
Let Law be content with the four we just sent him.
Four base-born churls, a beggar's offering. Scum like that will never stop the snow. She might.
The she-bear spoke.
And if you burn her, and the snow still fall, what then? Who will you burn next? Me?
Asher could hold her tongue no longer.
Why not Sir Clayton? Perhaps Law would like one of his own. A faithful man who will sing his praises as the flames lick at his cock.
Sir Justin laughed. Suggs was less amused.
Enjoy your giggle, Massey. If the snow keeps falling, we will see who's laughing then.
He glanced at the dead men on their stakes, smiled, and went off to join Sir Godfrey and the other Queen's men.
My champion,
Asher said to Justin Massey. He deserved that much, whatever his motives.
Thank you for the rescue, sir. It will not win you friends amongst the Queen's men, said the she-bear. Have you lost your faith in Red Relaw?
I have lost faith in more than that, Massey said, his breath a pale mist in the air.
But I still believe in supper. Will you join me, my ladies?
Ellie Mormont shook her head.
I have no appetite, nor I, but you had best choke down some horse meat all the same, or you may soon wish you had. We had 800 horses when we marched from Deepwood Mott. Last night the count was 64.
That did not shock her. Almost all of their big destriers had failed, including Massey's own. Most of their palfreys were gone as well. Even the garrons of the Northmen were faltering for want of fodder.
But what did they need horses for?
Stannis was no longer marching anywhere. The sun and moon and stars had been gone so long that Asher was starting to wonder whether she had dreamed them.
I will eat.
Ellie shook her head. Not me.
Let me look after Lady Asher, then, Sir Justin told her. You have my word. I shall not permit her to escape.
The she-bear gave her grudging assent, deaf to the japery in his tone. They parted there, Ellie to her tent, she and Justin Massey to the long hall. It was not far, but the drifts were deep, the wind was gusty, and Asher's feet were blocks of ice. Her ankles stabbed at her with every step. Small and mean as it was, the long hall was the largest building in the village, so the lords and captains had taken it for themselves, while Stannis settled into the stone watchtower by the lakeshore. A pair of guardsmen flanked its door, leaning on tall spears. One lifted the greased door flap for Massey, and Sir Justin escorted Asher through to the blessed warmth within. Benches and trestle tables ran along either side of the hall, with room for 50 men, though twice that number had squeezed themselves inside. A fire trench had been dug down the middle of the earthen floor, with a row of smoke holes in the roof above. The wolves had taken to sitting on one side of the trench, the knights and southern lords upon the other. The southerners looked a sorry lot, Asher thought. Gaunt and hollow-cheeked, some pale and sick, others with red and wind-scoured faces. By contrast, the Northmen seemed hale and healthy, big ruddy men with beards as thick as bushes, clad in fur and iron. They might be cold and hungry too, but the marching had gone easier for them, with their garrons and their bare paws. Asher peeled off her fur mittens, wincing as she flexed her fingers. Pain shut up her legs as her half-frozen feet began to thaw in the warmth. The crofters had left behind a good supply of peat when they fled, so the air was hazy with smoke and the rich earthy smell of burning turf. She hung her cloak on a peg inside the door after shaking off the snow that clung to it. Sir Justin found them places on the bench and fetched supper for the both of them, ale and chunks of horse meat, charred black outside and red within. Asher took a sip of ale and fell upon the horse flesh. The portion was smaller
than the last she'd tasted, but her belly still rumbled at the smell of it. "My thanks, sir," she said, as blood and grease ran down her chin. "Justin, I insist." Massey cut his own meat into chunks and stabbed one with his dagger. Down the table, Will Foxglove was telling the man around him that Stannis would resume his march on Winterfell 3 days hence. He'd had it from the lips of one of the grooms who tended the king's horses.
"His grace has seen victory in his fires," Foxglove said. "A victory that will be sung of for 1,000 years in Lord's Castle and Peasant's Hut alike."
Justin Massey looked up from his horse meat. "The cold count last night reached 80. He pulled a piece of gristle from his teeth and flicked it to the nearest dog. "If we march, we will die by the hundreds."
"We will die by the thousands if we stay here," said Sir Humphrey Clifton. "Press on or die, I say."
"Press on and die," I answered. "And if we reach Winterfell, what then? How do we take it? Half our men are so weak, they can scarce put one foot before another. Will you set them to scaling walls, building siege towers?"
"We should remain here until the weather breaks," said Sir Ormond Wilde,
a cadaverous old knight whose nature gave the lie to his name. Asher had heard rumours that some of the men-at-arms were wagering on which of the great knights and lords would be the next to die. Sir Ormond had emerged as a clear favourite. "And how much coin was placed on me, I wonder," Asher thought. "Perhaps there is still time to put down a wager."
"Here, at least, we have some shelter," Wilde was insisting. "And there are fish in the lakes."
"Too few fish and too many fishermen," Lord Peasbury said gloomily.
He had good reason for gloom. It was his men Sir Godfrey had just burned, and there were some in this very hall who had been heard to say that Peasbury himself surely knew what they were doing, and might even have shared in their feasts.
"He's not wrong,"
grumbled Ned Woods, one of the scouts from Deepwood. Noseless Ned, he was called. Frostbite had claimed the tip of his nose 2 winters past. Woods knew the Wolfwood as well as any man alive. Even the king's proudest lords had learned to listen when he spoke.
"I know them lakes. You've been on them like maggots on a corpse, hundreds of you. Cut so many holes in the ice, it's a bloody wonder more haven't fallen through. Out by the island, their spaces look like a cheese the rat's been at."
He shook his head.
"Lakes are done. You fish them out."
"All the more reason to march," insisted Humphrey Clifton. "If death is our fate, let us die with swords in hand."
It was the same argument as last night and the night before. Press on and die, stay here and die, fall back and die.
"Feel free to perish as you wish, Humphrey," said Justin Massey. "Myself, I would sooner live to see another spring." "As some might call that craven," Lord Peasbury replied.
"Better a craven than a cannibal."
Peasbury's face twisted in sudden fury.
"You..."
"Death is part of war, Justin." Sir Richard Hope stood inside the door, his dark hair damp with melting snow. "Those who march with us will have a share in all the plunder we take from Bolton and his bastard, and a greater share of glory, undying. Those too weak to march must fend for themselves, but you have my word. We shall send food once we have taken Winterfell."
"You will not take Winterfell."
"We will," came a cackle from the high table, where Arnulf of Carstark sat with his son Arthur and 3 grandsons.
Lord Arnulf shoved himself up, a vulture rising from its prey. One spotted hand clutched at his son's shoulder for support.
"We'll take it for the Ned and for his daughter. Aye."
and for the young wolf, too, him who was so cruelly slaughtered. Me and mine will show the way, if need be. I've said as much to his good grace, the king. March, I said, and before the moon can turn, we'll all be bathing in the blood of Freys and Boltons.
Men began to stamp their feet, to pound their fists against the tabletop.
Almost all were Northmen, Asher noted. Across the fire trench, the southern lords sat silent on the benches. Justin Massey waited until the uproar had died away. Then he said, "Your courage is admirable, Lord Carstark, but courage would not breach the walls of Winterfell. How do you mean to take the castle, pray? With snowballs?" One of Lord Arnulf's grandsons gave answer.
"We'll cut down trees for rams to break the gates."
"And die," another grandson made himself heard. "We'll make ladders scale the walls." "And die." Up spoke Arthur Carstark, Lord Arnulf's younger son. "We'll raise siege towers and die and die and die." Sir Justin rolled his eyes. "Gods be good, are all you Carstarks mad?" "Gods," said Richard Horp, "you forget yourself, Justin. We have but one god here. Speak not of demons in this company. Only the Lord of Light can save us now. Wouldn't you agree?" He put his hand upon the hilt of his sword, as if for emphasis, but his eyes never left the face of Justin Massey. Beneath that gaze, Sir Justin wilted. "The Lord of Light, aye. My faith runs as deep as your own, Richard. You know that. It is your courage I question, Justin, not your faith. You have preached defeat every step of the way since we rode forth from Deepwood Mott. It makes me wonder whose side you're on." A flush crept up Massey's neck. "I will not stay here to be insulted." He wrenched his damp cloak down from the wall so hard that Asher heard it tear, then stalked past Horp and through the door. A blast of cold air blew through the hall, raising ashes from the fire trench and fanning its flames a little brighter.
"Broken quick as that," thought Asher, "my champion is made of suet."
Even so, Sir Justin was one of the few who might object should the Queen's men try to burn her. So she rose to her feet, donned her own cloak, and followed him out into the blizzard. She was lost before she had gone 10 yards. Asher could see the beacon fire burning atop the watchtower, a faint orange glow floating in the air. Elsewise, the village was gone. She was alone in a white world of snow and silence, ploughing through snowdrifts as high as her thighs.
"Justin!"
she called. There was no answer. Somewhere to her left, she heard a horse whicker.
"The poor thing sounds frightened. Perhaps he knows that he's to be tomorrow's supper."
Asher pulled her cloak about her tightly. She blundered back onto the village green unknowing. The pinewood stakes still stood, charred and scorched, but not burnt through. The chains about the dead had cooled by now, she saw, but still held the corpses fast in their iron embrace. A raven was perched atop one, pulling at the tatters of burned flesh that clung to its blackened skull. The blowing snow had covered the ashes at the base of the pyre and crept up the dead man's leg as far as his ankle.
"The old gods mean to bury him," Asher thought. "This was no work of theirs."
"Take a good long gander, cunt,"
the deep voice of Clayton Sugg said behind her.
"You look just as pretty once you're roasted. Tell me, can squids scream?"
"God of my fathers, if you can hear me in your watery halls beneath the waves, grant me just one small throwing axe."
The drowned god did not answer. He seldom did. That was the trouble with gods.
"Have you seen Sir Justin? That prancing fool? What do you want with him, cunt? If it's a fuck you need,
I'm more man than Massey.
Cunt again.
It was odd how men like Suggs used that word to demean women, when it was the only part of a woman they valued. And Suggs was worse than middle little.
When he says the word, he means it.
Your king gels men for rape, she reminded him. Sir Clayton chuckled. The king's half blind from staring into fires. But have no fear, cunt. I'll not rape you. I'd need to kill you after, and I'd sooner see you burn.
There's that horse again. Do you hear that?
Hear what?
A horse. No, horses. More than one.
She turned her head, listening. The snow did queer things to sound. It was hard to know which direction it had come from.
Is this some squid game? I don't hear.
Sugg scowled.
Bloody hell. Riders!
He fumbled at his sword belt, his hands clumsy in their fur and leather gloves, and finally succeeded in ripping his long sword from its scabbard. By then the riders were upon them. They emerged from the storm like a troop of wraiths, big men on small horses, made even bigger by the bulky furs they wore. Swords rode on their hips, singing their soft steel song as they rattled in their scabbards. Asher saw a battle axe strapped to one man's saddle, a war hammer on another's back. Shields they bore as well, but so obscured by snow and ice that the arms upon them could not be read. For all her layers of wool and fur and boiled leather, Asher felt naked standing there.
A horn, she thought. I need a horn to rouse the camp. Run, you stupid cunt, Sir Clayton shouted. Run, warn the king. Lord Bolton is upon us.
A brute he might have been, but Suggs did not want for courage. Sword in hand, he strode through the snow, putting himself between the riders and the king's tower, its beacon glimmering behind him like the orange eye of some strange god.
Who goes there? Halt! Halt!
The lead rider reined up before him. Behind were others, perhaps as many as a score. Asher had no time to count them. Hundreds more might be out there in the storm, coming hard upon their heels. Roose Bolton's entire host might be descending on them, hidden by darkness and swirling snow. These, though,
they are too many to be scouts and too few to make a vanguard.
And two were all in black.
Night's watch, she realized suddenly. Who are you? She called.
Friends, a half-familiar voice replied. We looked for you at Winterfell, but found only crow-food umber, beating drums and blowing horns. It took some time to find you. The rider vaulted from his saddle, pulled back his hood, and bowed. So thick was his beard, and so crusted with ice, that for a moment Asher did not know him. Then it came.
Triss, she said.
My lady, Christopher Butley took a knee. The maid is here as well. Rogan, Grimtongue, Fingers, Rook. Six of us, all those fit enough to ride. Crumb died of his wounds.
What is this?
Sir Clayton Suggs demanded.
You're one of hers. How did you get loose of Deep Woods dungeons?
Triss rose and brushed the snow from his knees.
Sybil Glover was offered a handsome ransom for our freedom, and chose to accept it in the name of the king.
What ransom?
Who would pay good coin for sea scum?
I did, sir. The speaker came forward on his garron. He was very tall, very thin, so long-legged that it was a wonder that his feet did not drag along the ground.
I had the need of a strong escort to see me safely to the king, and Lady Sibel had need of fewer mouths to feed.
A scarf concealed the tall man's features, but atop his head was perched the queerest hat Asher had seen since the last time she had sailed to Tyrosh, a brimless tower of some soft fabric, like three cylinders stacked one on top the other.
I was given to understand that I might find King Stannis here,
"'It is a most urgent that I speak with him at once.'
"'And who in seven stinking hells are you?'
The tall man slid gracefully from his garron, removed his peculiar hat, and bowed.
"'I have the honour to be Tycho Nestoris, a humble servant of the Iron Bank of Braavos.'
Of all the strange things that might have come riding out of the night, the last one Asher Greyjoy would ever have expected was a Braavosi banker. It was too absurd. She had to laugh.
"'King Stannis has taken the watchtower for his seat. Sir Caton will be pleased to show you to him, I'm sure.'
"'That would be most kind. Time is of the essence.'
The banker studied her with shrewd dark eyes.
"'You are the Lady Asher of House Greyjoy, unless I am mistaken.' "'I am Asher of House Greyjoy, aye. Opinions differ on whether I'm a lady.'
The Braavosi smiled.
"'We've brought a gift for you.'
He beckoned to the men behind him.
"'We had expected to find the king at Winterfell.' This same blizzard has engulfed the castle, alas. Beneath its walls we found Mors Umber with a troop of raw green boys waiting for the king's coming. He gave us this. A girl and an old man, thought Asher,
as the two were dumped rudely in the snow before her. The girl was shivering violently, even in her furs. If she had not been so frightened, she might even have been pretty. Though the tip of her nose was black with frostbite. The old man, well, no one would ever think him comely. She had seen scarecrows with more flesh. His face was a skull with skin, his hair bone white and filthy, and he stank. Just the sight of him filled Asher with revulsion. He raised his eyes.
"Sister, see, this time I knew you."
Asher's heart skipped a beat.
"Theon?"
His lips skinned back in what might have been a grin. Half his teeth were gone, and half of those still left him were broken and splintered.
"Theon," he repeated. "My name is Theon. You have to know your name."
Tyrion. On a hill overlooking the King's Road, a long trestle table of rough-hewn pine had been erected beneath an elm tree and covered with a golden cloth. There, beside his pavilion, Lord Tywin took his evening meal with his chief knights and lords bannermen, his great crimson and gold standard waving overhead from a lofty pike. Tyrion arrived late, saddle-sore and sour, all too vividly aware of how amusing he must look as he waddled up the slope to his father. The day's march had been long and tiring. He thought he might get quite drunk tonight. It was twilight, and the air was alive with drifting fireflies. The cooks were serving the meat course, 5 suckling pigs, skin seared and crackling, a different fruit in every mouth. The smell made his mouth water. "My pardons," he began, taking his place on the bench beside his uncle.
"Perhaps I'd best charge you with burying our dead, Tyrion," Lord Tywin said. "If you are as late to battle as you are to table, the fighting will all be done by the time you arrive." "Oh, surely you can save me a peasant or two, father," Tyrion replied. "Not too many. I wouldn't want to be greedy."
He filled his wine cup and watched a serving man carve into the pig. The crisp skin crackled under his knife, and hot juice ran from the meat. It was the loveliest sight Tyrion had seen in ages.
"Sir Adam's outriders say the Stark host has moved south from the Twins," his father reported as his trencher was filled with slices of pork. "Lord Frey's levies have joined them. They are likely no more than a day's march north of us."
"Oh, please, father," Tyrion said, "I'm about to eat."
"Does the thought of facing the Stark boy unman you, Tyrion? Your brother Jaime would be eager to come to grips with him."
I'd sooner come to grips with that pig. Rubstock is not half so tender, and he never smelt as good.
Lord Leffard, the sour bird, who had charge of their stores and supplies, leaned forward.
I hope your savages do not share your reluctance, else we've wasted our good steel on them. My savages will put your steel to excellent use, my lord,
Tyrion replied. When he had told Leffard he needed arms and armour to equip the 300 men Ulf had fetched down out of the foothills, you would have thought he'd asked the man to turn his virgin daughters over to their pleasure. Lord Leffard frowned.
I saw that great hairy one today, the one who insisted that he must have two battle axes, the heavy black steel ones with twin crescent blades. Shagger likes to kill with either hand, Tyrion said, as a trencher of steaming pork was laid in front of him. He still had that wood axe of his strapped to his back. Shagger is of the opinion that three axes are even better than two.
Tyrion reached the thumb and forefinger into the salt dish and sprinkled a hefty pinch over his meat. Sir Kevin leaned forward.
We had a thought to put you and your wildlings in the vanguard when we come to battle.
Sir Kevin seldom had a thought that Lord Tywin had not had first. Tyrion had skewered a chunk of meat on the point of his dagger and brought it to his mouth. Now he lowered it.
The vanguard, he repeated dubiously.
Either his lord father had a new respect for Tyrion's abilities, or he'd decided to rid himself of his embarrassing git for good. Tyrion had the gloomy feeling he knew which.
They seem ferocious enough, Sir Kevin said. Ferocious.
Tyrion realized he was echoing his uncle like a trained bird. His father watched, judging him, weighing every word.
Let me tell you how ferocious they are. Last night, a moon brother stabbed a stone crow over a sausage. So today, as we made camp, three stone crows seized the man and opened his throat for him. Perhaps they were hoping to get the sausage back, I couldn't say. Bronn managed to keep Shagger from chopping off the dead man's cock, which was fortunate, but even so, Ulf is demanding blood money, which Conn and Shagger refuse to pay.
When soldiers lack discipline, the fault lies with their Lord Commander, his father said.
His brother Jamie had always been able to make men follow him eagerly and die for him if need be. Tyrion lacked that gift. He bought loyalty with gold and compelled obedience with his name.
A bigger man would be able to put fear in them. Is that what you're saying, my lord?
Lord Tywin Lannister turned to his brother.
If my son's men will not obey his commands, perhaps the vanguard is not the place for him. No doubt he would be more comfortable in the rear, guarding our baggage train.
Do me no kindnesses, father, he said angrily. If you have no other command to offer me, I'll lead your van.
Lord Tywin studied his dwarf son. I said nothing about command. You will serve under Sir Gregor.
Tyrion took one bite of pork, chewed a moment, and spit it out angrily.
I find I am not hungry after all, he said, climbing awkwardly off the bench. Pray excuse me, my lords.
Lord Tywin inclined his head, dismissing him. Tyrion turned and walked away. He was conscious of their eyes on his back as he waddled down the hill. A great gust of laughter went up from behind him, but he did not look back. He hoped they all choked on their suckling pigs. Dusk had settled, turning all the banners black. The Lannister camp sprawled for miles between the river and the King's Road. In amongst the men and the horses and the trees, it was easy to get lost, and Tyrion did. He passed a dozen great pavilions and 100 cook fires. Fireflies drifted amongst the tents like wandering stars. He caught the scent of garlic sausage, spiced and savoury, so tempting it made his empty stomach growl. Away in the distance, he heard voices raised in some bawdy song. A giggling woman raced past him, naked beneath a dark cloak, her drunken pursuer stumbling over tree roots. Farther on, two spearmen faced each other across a little trickle of a stream, practicing their thrust and parry in the fading light, their chests bare and slick with sweat. No one looked at him. No one spoke to him. No one paid him any mind. He was surrounded by men sworn to House Lannister, a vast host, 20,000 strong. And yet, he was alone. When he heard the deep rumble of Shagger's laughter booming through the dark, he followed it to the stone crows in their small corner of the night. Conn, son of Carad, waved a tankard of ale.
"Tirion Hoffman, come sit by our fire. Share meat with the stone crows. We have an ox."
"I can see that, Conn, son of Carad." The huge red carcass was suspended over a roaring fire, skewered on a spit the size of a small tree. No doubt it was a small tree. Blood and grease dripped down into the flames as two stone crows turned the meat.
"I thank you. Send for me when the ox is cooked."
From the look of it, that might even be before the battle. He walked on. Each clan had its own cook fire. Black ears do not eat with stone crows. Stone crows do not eat with moon brothers. And no one ate with burn men. The modest tent he had coaxed out of Lord Lifford's stores had been erected in the centre of the four fires. Tirion found Bronn sharing a skin of wine with the new servants. Lord Tywin had sent him a groom and a body servant to see to his needs, and even insisted he take a squire. They were seated around the embers of a small cook fire. A girl was with them, slim, dark-haired, no more than 18 by the look of her. Tirion studied her face for a moment before he spied fish bones in the ashes.
"What did you eat?"
"Trout, my lord," said his groom. "Bronn caught them."
"Trout," he thought. "Suckling pig, damn my father."
He stared mournfully at the bones, his belly rumbling. His squire, a boy with the unfortunate name of Podrick Payne, swallowed whatever he'd been about to say. The lad was a distant cousin to Sir Ilion Payne, the king's headsman, and almost as quiet, although not for want of a tongue. Tirion had made him stick it out once, just to be certain.
"Definitely a tongue," he had said. "Some day you must learn to use it."
At the moment he did not have the patience to try and coax a thought out of the lad, whom he suspected had been inflicted on him as a cruel jape. Tirion turned his attention back to the girl.
"Is this her?"
he asked Bronn. She rose gracefully and looked down at him from the lofty height of 5 feet or more.
"It is, my lord, and she can speak for herself, if it please you."
He cocked his head to one side.
"I am Tirion, of House Lannister. Men call me the Imp. My mother named me Shay. Men call me often."
Bronn laughed, and Tirion had to smile.
"Into the tent, Shay, if you'll be so kind."
He lifted the flap and held it for her. Inside, he knelt to light a candle. The life of a soldier was not without certain compensations. Whenever you have a camp, you are certain to have camp followers. At the end of a day's march, Tirion had sent Bronn back to find him a likely whore.
"I would prefer one who is reasonably young, with as pretty a face as you can find," he had said. "If she has washed sometime this year, I shall be glad. If she hasn't, wash her. Be certain that you tell her who I am, and warn her of what I am."
Jick had not always troubled to do that. There was a look the girls got in their eyes sometimes when they first beheld the lordling they had been hired to pleasure. A look that Tirion Lannister did not ever care to see again. He lifted the candle and looked her over. Bronn had done well enough. She was doe-eyed and slim, with small, firm breasts, and a smile that was by turns shy, insolent, and wicked. He liked that.
"Shall I take my gown off, my lord?"
she asked.
"In good time. Are you a maiden, she?"